Free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, see the past archives, and see what's coming up in the next few weeks, and see the phone numbers if you want to call in, ask any questions. Our guest today is Sean Frayne. He is the inventor of a technology called the Wind Belt. The company is Humdinger, and this is a technology that allows for low wind speed energy harvesting for sub 100 watt scale, super inexpensive, for example. We're talking $2 to $5 for a generator for a home system that could power radios and things like that. So, Sean, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sterling.
Well, tell us, how does this, what's the design essence of this wind belt?
The design essence, I guess if I could capture it in kind of one goofy sentence, is that the wind belt is more like the vibrating bow of a musical instrument, like a violin bow, let's say, as opposed to a spinning airplane wing, which is sort of what the conventional way of harvesting wind power is more akin to. You know, a spinning turbine or turbine is just a spinning airfoil, and that works really, really well on the large scale. And you can get the cost down quite a bit because you focus in a huge area of wind down to, just a little rotor, and your losses in your bearings and whatnot in those huge systems aren't such a big deal. But when you scale down those sorts of conventional systems, what you start to find is your losses in your bearings and, you know, just how the momentum of your system is a little bit different than it is on a large scale. All these things add up to making turbine-based systems very inefficient on the small scale, and that's inefficiency, on an energy basis in terms of how much energy is in the wind and how much you can pull out, but it's also inefficient in terms of cost. And really, for me, that was the biggest concern, and that's what led to the development of the wind belt, which, to get to your question, is just a taut band of material, and it has some magnetics and some coils attached to it, and depending on certain characteristics of that band and of the whole system, you can make it undergo what's called an aeroelastic flutter oscillation. This oscillation is most well-known. Its most well-known embodiment was in the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapse. So we're just kind of using that powerful effect to capture wind on the small scale and use that for small-scale electrical applications.
When you were talking to me the other day, you were explaining that it's not really a harmonic resonance that's going on here because there's quite a wide band of wind speeds that it works on.
Yeah, that's from just kind of seeing what people have thought about this technology and whatnot, and the feedback's been largely encouraging, but thankfully at least there's some dissent, so it's not at least not just accepted or kind of brushed aside offhand. A lot of folks think that this new style of technology, and I have to just kind of emphasize that this is just coming out of the lab, like I say, kind of crawling out of water onto land, so to speak. And, it's not going to hit the markets for some time, but it's pretty exciting that we've gotten through this proof of concept demonstration phase. But anyhow, you're right, it's not a resonant effect. A lot of people think that it works at one specific speed, and for every other speed, you have to retension the band. Not a bad thought, but that kind of harkens back to a misunderstanding of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapse. A lot of people, and actually a lot of physics professors, and I think my own physics professors in middle school when I first saw the videos, they typically will teach that Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapsed because it was resonating with the wind. You know, the typical definition of resonance in a physics class, you know, in a nature physics class, is you kind of have something that has a beat. Let's say the wind has kind of a beat to it, and then you have something else that natural frequency sort of matches that beat. So the bridge would be matching the beat of the wind. The thing is, with the Tacoma Narrows, there was no beat in the wind. It was just a constantly flowing, the wind was at a constant speed. So what it actually is, it's kind of more of a positive feedback loop. You're in the instance of the bridge, because I think most people understand that analogy. The bridge started to pull, there were some lift forces as the wind kind of caught underneath the bridge. The bridge started to kind of arc up a little bit in the center or near the end, depending on the mode of vibration. Then the tension kind of forces in the bridge overcame those lift forces, swooped the bridge back down. Suddenly those lift forces are over top the bridge. It pushes the bridge down a little more. Then the tension forces overcome, you know, and then it gets caught in this loop. And that's sort of what we're taking advantage of. So it's not quite right to call it resonant. I mean, a resonant effect. What is? It is important. Resonance is important from the standpoint of you need your band and the whole system to resonate with itself, sort of efficiently. So this system consists of a few components. There's the magnetics. There's a power conditioner. There's the mounting structure, and the band, and whatnot. And you know, you need those structures to resonate well with each other. Just in the same way, if you designed a musical instrument, you would want the body of the musical instrument to resonate well with the pluck of a string, let's say, because if you didn't, you would get something, but it wouldn't be a sound that lasted that long. And in the analogy, if you don't have everything resonating well in this system, then you're losing some energy. You know, your sound isn't sustained, so to speak. So hopefully that answers that question for some of the audience. The prototypes that have been shown online a little bit work from around 4 to 5 miles per hour up to around roughly 14 miles per hour without any retensioning. And we've done some recent tests that show on the larger scale this whole dynamic tensioning issue to capture a larger bandwidth of speeds isn't necessarily necessary.
Right. And before we go further on that thought, I'd like to back up just a little bit and paint a little bit of a visual for the audience. As I picture this, what you have is it's like if you take a ribbon and you hold it up in the wind, the ribbon will vibrate back and forth. Mm-hmm. And all you're doing is you're just putting a little magnet right on the end of on both ends. And then you have a coil that so that as that ribbon is vibrating back and forth, the magnet goes in and out of the coil. And as it goes in and out of the coil, it generates electricity, and then you're pulling that off. You're running it through a conditioner so that you can then get some clean power out to run some lower power systems, whether it's a radio or whatever. And you were actually, I think, describing to me of using this to power a battery and then using the battery to power any appliances you want to be running.
Right. That's most likely the variation that will be used in a rural lighting application or even powering small wireless sensors, let's say. You would always typically, because the wind doesn't blow constantly, you would always typically have some sort of buffer, such as a capacitor or some sort of rechargeable battery. But your visual is fairly accurate. What's important, an important distinction, is you would be holding that ribbon with two hands,
mm-hmm.
because this effect kind of needs, you know, two or more fixture points to get it going, just in the same way the Tacoma Narrows Bridge did, more or less. That makes this sort of generator distinct from pretty much one of the other few things in the prior art that related to turbineless wind power, and those are what I call the flappers. Those are more like a flag that use the dominant effect there is vortice shedding. So with a flag and a flagpole, as the air flows around the flagpole, you start to have these little vortexes of air spin off the flagpole at a very, very predictable frequency, at least for a cylinder like the flagpole. And that gets the fabric of your flag going. You know, I've been working on this for 4 or 5 years pretty actively, and that's one of the first things I tried and just discovered pretty quickly that it wasn't a very energetic effect, at least in the air. In other fluids it is. You know, in other denser media, it's definitely something to be contended with. But in air, it didn't do so much. So you're holding your ribbon in your visual with two hands. You have some magnetics, some magnets, so let's say little button magnets, attached to the ribbon near one end. That's an important distinction as well. And then you have your coils arranged in some way around those magnets so that you can capture some of the changing magnetic field as those magnets move. You know, the whole magnet and coil thing, there's a kajillion variations of that, and, you know, all the way, you know, almost 200 years ago, I guess, from when Faraday first discovered, you know, that moving a moving magnetic field across a coil gave you some voltage in the coil. That, you know, ever since then, people have really nailed down more or less most of the configurations for how you can arrange a coil with reference to a magnet and get it to do some sort of useful electrical work. But the challenge for a wind generator, just generally speaking, in my view, is threefold. The first challenge is you have to figure out a way to capture some area of wind and concentrate that energy down to as small an area as possible. In the wind belt, it does that by kind of focusing kind of this iris of this kind of cross-sectional area of wind that the band is vibrating in, all towards this one little button magnet that's vibrating. In a big turbine, you're doing it by having a big spinning airfoil, and all that spinning kinetic energy is kind of focused down towards your gearbox and all your magnetics in there. So that's number one. You have to figure out a way to, harvest the wind. The second thing is you have to figure out a way to convert the kinetic energy in your magnet or your coil, whichever one's moving, and get that to efficiently convert from kinetic energy into electrical energy. That's, you know, I don't want to say it's a solved problem, because for each different generator, you always have different nuanced aspects to it, but by and large, that part's been looked at quite a lot, and you just have to figure out how it's particularly configured to your generator. And then three is, how do you condition the power? For me, and for the folks I was working with, the issue wasn't conditioning the power as principal, because we knew we could do it through off-the-shelf items, but those would add up to be $10 or $20, and for these very small generators, that was now much more expensive than the generator itself. So we just had to design very small, inexpensive power conditioning units that could hit our price point. So there's sort of those three things: harvest the wind, convert the kinetic energy of some moving magnet or coil into electrical energy efficiently, and then condition the power. What the wind belt does, what the wind belt brings to the table, I think, more than anything else, is showing that there's a new way to do number one, which is harvest that area of wind power. And get it to do some sort of useful work. Basically, you don't have to have something that spins anymore to necessarily have a way to convert wind power into electrical power. And that's what's pretty exciting, I think, from our perspective, and I think from some of the folks who are looking at this.
Now, when we look at your prototype, you know, you're holding this thing that is maybe 2 inches thick and maybe 2 feet wide or long, and I could picture a mini farm of those coming across the top of the eave of your house, for example. So rather than just having one up there with enough energy to charge or to run a radio, you have the whole width of your house with these $2 each, or $3, whatever they end up being. And then you pull off all that energy. Couldn't you see something along those lines of using multiple units to basically get as much energy as you need?
Conceivably. So the units that have appeared a little bit online, the ones that, like you're saying, are about, I guess, 2 inches or so high and, you know, a little more than 2 feet, I think, long. They're flat generators, but those were designed to kind of kill two birds with one stone. They were designed to power up some wireless sensor units to be used in the ducting of a building, so then you could, you know, continuously power these wireless sensors, which are giving you information about the temperature and humidity and airflow and whatnot through your duct, so you can make a more energy-efficient building. The problem there was, you know, people didn't want to replace the batteries and these thousands of sensors through their building. So that was one of the birds, I guess. The other one, not to get birds into this whole equation, but the other side of the coin was this whole project was originally started to focus on rural electrification on a very, very small scale in Haiti, by and large, but, you know, expanding that kind of to a lot of developing countries where they're not on the grid, where the dominant fuel source in a lot of cases for lighting, something like kerosene, you spend $5 to $10 a month on, you know, fuel for this very, very poor quality light, poor quality from an efficiency standpoint, but also from a health and fire hazard standpoint. Was it possible, the question was, is it possible to design a whole system, including the energy-producing means, you know, whether that be a solar panel or a wind generator, you know, battery and some white LEDs, and maybe some connectors for a radio and whatnot, design that whole thing so it could sell for, let's say, $10. So about a little more than 1 month's worth of kerosene fuel costs. That was a challenge. Turned out that turbines couldn't do it, so that's what led to this particular scale of wind generator. So I guess what I'm getting to is the scales that have been pictured, while they can be clustered up, as you mentioned, and have that power gang together, it's for a house in the States, the scale that the wind generator, the one that's gotten some press, that's not the scale that you would necessarily use to address that particular market. That said, we're definitely experimenting and are getting very positive results on the larger scale. And in that event, you could still gang up, you know, several of these wind belts, and they'd be a little bit higher scale, and then you could conceivably do what you're saying. I personally don't necessarily think that is the biggest market for this type of technology, but definitely it's something we're looking at. And, you know, again, all this is, I don't want to warrant that we've nailed down, you know, a kilowatt-sized wind belt, because I don't want to get people's hopes up, but it's something we're actively investigating.
Okay, let's go back to something we went away from earlier. We were talking about the 4 to 5 mile per hour is where it starts vibrating, and it goes up to about 14 miles per hour without retentioning. But you mentioned to me that it's not that it stops working at 14, but that you're not getting the increase in wind velocity proportional to the output of energy produced if you don't retention.
Right. So it starts to hiccup, kind of. It starts to jump ahead of itself, at least on these smaller scales for doing this rural lighting and power intensities and whatnot. Those prototypes start to, they get ahead of themselves, and the belt just can't keep up. But the, it still produces power, but you're not getting, because the power available in wind is, the cube of the, it's kind of proportional to the cube of the wind speed. At a slightly higher wind speed, you get a lot more energy. And it's disappointing that the small-scale wind belts can't capture that additional energy. While it does become constant, it would be nice if they operated up to, the ideal, I think, wouldn't necessarily be that you can capture all the way down to 5 miles per hour. There's not a whole lot of energy available in 5 mile per hour wind. Maybe if you could cut in around 8 miles per hour, let's say, or 7 or 8 miles per hour, and then go all the way up to, let's say, 25 miles per hour without having to do retentioning, and then your wind belt outputted a constant a constant amount of energy after that 25 miles per hour without breaking down, then that would be fine, because then we capture quite a good chunk of wind speed there. But one of the things we're excited about is that on different scales, it seems as if that bandwidth, and I'm misusing that word, but it seems as if that speed bandwidth is more forgiving. So I don't want people to get hung up on, I know there are people out there experimenting with this technology, and that's great. So I don't want people to get hung up on this fact that on one particular scale there are certain issues, and on one particular scale there's a certain form to the generator that's been kind of pictured online. This is so far a very flexible technology. It can take air from a lot of different angles, a lot of different speeds, and appears to work at some different scales. So, hopefully that's what people go home with. And, I should just say, just so the lawyers don't glare at me after this, that this is there's quite a few patents pending on this technology, but largely in developed countries. There's no sense in patenting in Haiti or El Salvador, anywhere in the developing world by and large. So the rule of thumb for people who want to experiment with this technology is that they can experiment to their heart's content, and no one can stop them, including me, and there's no way I'd want to. And if they discover their own additions to this technology, which are above and beyond kind of these fundamental discoveries, and they're free, of course, they can consult with their own counsel for this, but by and large, they're free to patent those refinements. But if they ever wanted to sell or manufacture this in the countries that we have patent protection, like the States or the EU or Japan or China or whatnot, then there would just have to be some agreement with between us and whoever was the purchaser. But in all the developing world, which I know is where a lot of people are trying to retool this technology to their particular needs, it's completely open source, and that's kind of the goal. Any proceeds, my whole objective in marketing this, and I always cringe a little bit, but my whole objective personally is to generate enough revenue from these first world applications so that I can reroute the revenue through myself as much as I control. I don't control everything in the company, but as much as I control, so that this flows back, by and large, to the developing markets, the emerging markets, And, you know, so just to reiterate, because I muddled that point a little bit, everyone should feel free to experiment and discover their own things, and I think that's awesome, and it's, I'm really curious how this whole idea of open source hardware is going to develop. But I just have to say, so people don't get their heart broken, that it is patent-pending sort of thing in developed countries, but they can sell, manufacture, do whatever they want in the developing world. And that's how all technologies, by and large, except for pharmaceuticals, work, is that no one patents stuff in the developing world. So it's kind of automatically open source there.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that it kind of works out that way, because the developing world is where they need it the most,
right.
The open source type of model. Yeah. In terms of the areas of exploration on this technology, just using my imagination, I could see the material science coming into the fabric that you would use for the vibrating band, or belt as you call it. Another place of exploration would be the shape of the holder. Do you just use flat, or do you use some kind of convex? You know, what happens
right.
if you vary the shape, the distance that you allow the thing to vibrate, the tension and the modifying of the tension. There's a lot of areas that could be experimented on to kind of optimize this effect.
Definitely, definitely. This is really, really, you know, although I've been working on it for some time, you know, 4 or 5 years, it's really just, it's a technology that's just really starting to come into its own a little bit, and there's a lot of work to be done, is I guess what it boils down to. There's the material science of the belt. You know, we have a material that works well, but there's certainly something that works better. You know, it's designing more efficient sort of shapes, like you're saying. It's designing more efficient mounting structures that resonate better with the whole system. It's designing different configurations of the magnetics and, you know, the coils and whatnot. It's experimenting with the different scales. So that's something that is very exciting because, you know, you look outside and you see, you know, all sorts of stuff, you know, flopping around in the wind. You'll see kind of a stretched out, you know, anything that's stretched out now that I look at, you know, whether it be a power line or some sort of ribbon that's oscillating in the wind, it makes me think that, you know, one of the real potentials for this sort of technology is on these different scales, on these larger scales, if it scales, and that's a big, big if, but if it scales, then you can imagine, rather than having to send a, so I was just in the Galapagos with a friend, a colleague, and we were looking at some of the wind installations they had installed on one of the populated islands there. And so they have 3 wind turbines. I think they're about a megawatt each or something. They have to get these suckers shipped in from Spain. You have to kind of have a special ship that is designed to carry these huge turbine blades. It's kind of like you're transporting an airplane. Because you don't want micro cracks and whatnot to occur during the travel. Then you have to build, because a lot of times where you have a good wind resource, it's on the edge of a cliff or some awkward place, you have to build a big tower and a big crane to lift this, to lift all the parts and the turbine blade, you know, from sea level up onto your cliff. So that almost killed the project. And then you haven't even gotten started actually putting everything together. So this issue of how do you get an airplane basically spinning on the edge of a cliff, you know, that sort of problem with wind technology now leads me to really dream about and experiment with how, you know, the benefits of having a technology like the wind belt that you could have a role of material, and then, you know, some sort of electromagnetic generator components that are attached to that material, and you basically put it in, you know, you put several of those rolls of material and those magnetics and whatnot in, you know, just a cargo box, and you ship that out, and then you stretch this thing out across a gap, let's say in a valley or whatnot, or along, or you kind of stretch it out from a tower like you would a guy wire, and then you have a generator that's much easier to install and potentially much less expensive. And just because I'm a worrywart, you know, it's important for me to say that we haven't proven out those scales. So right now we're only kind of what you see online in terms of what's demoed is kind of what you get, and that's what we know works. But it,
well,
you know,
you
can't
also
help imagining.
Couldn't you also piggyback onto the existing infrastructure? For example, you could put it between the cables on a suspension bridge, where you
right.
wouldn't even hardly notice it, and yet you're using that structure as the backbone. And you don't even have to put up a new structure. You just paste it onto existing structures.
Definitely. And that, you know, kind of slashes the cost a little bit more. You know, the important thing for, I think, folks to realize is that there's no super special material that's used in this. They can literally, if they screw around enough, reproduce it with stuff that they can find virtually anywhere. And like you're saying, yeah, definitely strapping it onto existing structures is a real exciting option moving forward.
In as much as high winds are a problem for this, that it would kind of tear them up, since the materials are so cheap, would the labor be also cheap to just go in and replace it if, in case you have a high wind in it? It's like replacing a fuse, for example, is that you just go in, put in a new strap, hook it up to the, put your magnet up to it, and off you go.
Right, and, you know, it depends where you are, and it depends the scale, definitely. But in, you know, let's take Haiti as an example. If you had a wind belt that could work for, let's say, 6 months before it got torn up so much that you had to replace the belt, well, then you're replacing your least expensive part. If you can recapture the magnets that are mounted on the belt, then you're just losing a few cents, because, again, this isn't a super special material. And then you replace it, and, you know, if it's easy...
Wouldn't you want to engineer it so that you could actually, all the expensive parts stay intact and the cheapest part just blows away? You just go in and slip in a new piece of ribbon and hook it into the end of the magnet that is more solidly fastened, and it might not vibrate as well because it's not necessarily the same material, but it's still vibrating back and forth with that ribbon.
No, definitely, and that's a great, a few other folks have brought that up, and yeah, that's a great embodiment of the technology, especially once we know more about, so the problem is we haven't had a belt breakdown yet. They will, certainly. I mean, it's, again, not a super special material, so it will break down. But when replacement of the belt becomes something that, you know, when we know how often that has to happen, then that'll affect what we build into the design in terms of how easy it is to replace. Because it's always, you know, a balancing act between the cost of adding, you know, like in your example, let's say you have something that's supporting the magnets and kind of clips onto the belt, you know, something on the mounting structure. Then you, as you've mentioned, slip in the belt. You know, that adds extra cost, and we just have to determine where when that extra cost and complexity is warranted and when it's not. But it's a great point and something that we haven't explored too much yet, but when it comes up, I think we will. Incidentally, for Lifetime, you know, on the very small scale where we have what I'm calling kind of heel and stick flat wind generators or wind belts, you know, let's say you had a wind belt that was 6 inches long and, you know, a quarter of an inch high. You know, if you, and you had a little wireless sensor attached to that and you put that into the ducting of a building, that has to last 10 or 20 years, because you don't want to be replacing wind belts as often as you're replacing batteries, because that defeats the purpose. But on the larger scale, replacement definitely is something that I think is an option when it's it's the least expensive, the belt is the least expensive part of your system.
Mm-hmm. Back to an earlier thing we were talking about with intellectual property. This basic concept of the wind belt, is that something that you have nailed down in patent protection?
Well, we hope so. We have quite an array of patents pending on the fundamental technology, so not to get too into it because I get screamed at, but on the fundamentals, that's fairly nailed down. There's so much left to discover in this field that I believe, with anything that, if this actually does end up being as significant as we believe it will be in the coming years, then there's going to be a lot of players that enter with their own embodiments, and maybe they won't be able to claim the fundamental invention of it, but there's a lot of innovations that are going to have to be made by, I think, a lot of different parties to bring this new technology to market. This is the first time that I think most people have seen something that is a wind generator that doesn't spin. So I think there's quite a lot of room for other folks to put their mark on it.
One footnote that we've not mentioned, you were talking earlier about killing two birds with one stone, but this technology, talking about birds, actually would not pose any danger to birds in contrast to many of the wind turbines that are out there.
Well, we don't know. I was talking to the folks who installed the system, the big turbines in the Galapagos, and if there's a place where you have to worry about birds, it's probably the Galapagos Islands. And what they told me, and I don't know how true this is, but I'm taking their words at face value, is that it's not actually, by and large, most of the birds that get killed by wind installations aren't killed by the spinning turbine blades. They actually spin really slowly. What actually happens is you have miles sometimes of electrical lines that are, fanning out from your wind generators, and the birds run into those lines. You can't see them. And so what they did in the Galapagos is they buried the lines, and they think that's going to eliminate almost all their problems. It kind of makes sense to me. So, on very fundamental principle, I disagree with a lot of the criticism with currently existing wind technology. I still like turbines on the large scale. And this is not as efficient as large-scale turbines. That's something that people got confused about, is the claims about efficiency are really only for the very, very small-scale, very, very small-scale wind turbines that are only in experimental labs at universities. And we're not comparing efficiencies to, the large-scale wind turbines. We're not too far off, but it's definitely
your
not better.
Efficiencies come in the small scale, the low wind speeds.
Yeah, exactly. And if anyone's curious, they can go to the website, our website, humdingerwind.com, and I posted some references of some articles in Nature a few years ago. I read about, certain systems, small micro turbine systems in Nature, thought, well, it's published in Nature. That's a pretty good benchmark. You can't really get a more prestigious mark of approval. So that's one of the benchmarks we've been comparing against, and people can do their own due diligence to compare efficiency in terms of what cross-sectional area of wind the wind belt's cutting, and they can get an idea from the pictures and compare that to the claims in Nature and come up with their own. I'm confident they're going to come up with exactly what we got in terms of our claims, but, it was probably a bad move to have that published without the cited reference, because the term of art microturbine ranges from anywhere from, the 1 milliwatt scale up to, a kilowatt or more, so it's confusing.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, I know that's getting away from your question, but I just wanted to make sure to mention that nuance. But in terms of birds, I disagree with people's point that that is a considerable issue for wind turbines. It's an issue for, it seems, wind systems that have these high voltage lines coming off. And it's not that they're high voltage, it's just that the birds run into these lines, you know, coming off in it. Yeah.
We had a guest on here talking about wind turbines, and on those larger, those 5-megawatt blades, you know, generator systems where you have those huge, you know, 100-meter types of diameters, they might be spinning slowly in terms of RPM, but they're approaching the speed of sound on the ends of those blades.
And yes, definitely if something gets whacked by it, it's going to, it won't survive, but... So definitely, there are birds that get killed in turbine blades. The bigger issue, I think, is people that set up wind large wind installations have to consider whether they're in the migratory path. So I'm you know, if any bird got killed by any system that I designed, I would try to redesign the system or figure out exactly. You know, figure out whether more birds get killed by, you know, the pollution that's caused by, you know, coal-fired plants or whatnot. You know, some of the arguments that are out there, I know it's a big, big debate, but, you know, I think the biggest problem is miscitting of wind installations. It's having these, the power lines that are coming off your system, not having them buried underground, instead having them kind of strung up just like a net to catch these birds as they're flying by, and I think those, you know, I am not an expert on this aspect of wind, but from the folks I've talked to, it seems as if those really are the biggest issues, and if you really take a close look at that, then it's not as big an issue. Certainly, if you even have a slow-spinning turbine blade in the migratory path of some birds, and that is a big mistake. And I think that has happened.
Let's get back to your system, and I'm curious.
Sure, sure.
There are a number of people worldwide, from what I understand, who are working on this. How many do you know of that are experimenting with this, either replicating your effect or maybe trying to improve on what you've done?
So that I know of, and people are pretty friendly about this whole thing. I've been pretty open about, you know, giving out information as long as everyone understands, how this whole open source deal works. But, I don't know. There's architecture students in, San Jose that are designing systems that integrate this, into buildings. There's, you know, some folks in Delhi who are trying to design the system. There's people who I think are trying to make it in Spain and in Ecuador and all over the place. But people that I know of that have actually been working on reproducing the system, it's probably half a dozen. But I would assume there's quite a lot more who just haven't kept me up to date on what they're doing, which is cool. But I'm hoping that this is what happens and that people discover a lot of new stuff. Because as a small startup, we just cannot hope to discover, even a small percentage of what there is, if there's anything to this, which I think myself and a lot of other folks think there is.
One of the things that I'm not quite understanding, you
for
talk
sure.
about this as if it's just barely emerging. You talk about, you know, coming out from sea to land.
Yeah, right.
Early stages of evolution, and yet the concept seems sound. How soon do you think it'll be before this will be available commercially in its first iteration to, say, the Haiti application, for example?
Oh, so in terms of doing demonstrated, having first market tests and whatnot in Haiti, that's probably sooner than necessarily is in terms of, someone in the States being able to buy a wind belt. I'm just using, I've worked on quite a few other products, and those were simple ideas too at their fundamental, at the fundamental level. But what happens is, no matter how simple an idea is, or how simple a prototype is, or how simple a technology is, there's always issues when you're trying to bring it to market in terms of manufacturability, getting it, you know, making sure it's a stable system, getting the cost down, and whatnot. So that typically, from the stage of proof of concept to the launch of a product, and it depends on what type of product, but at minimum, it's 2 years sort of time frame to go from that proof of concept phase into the into a market launch. And for a lot of technologies, it's from 6 to 10 years. Even for things that you would think are really, really super simple. And why does it take that long? And, you know, there's just a lot of players that have to come in. And I don't know. That's just how it works. And so I'm trying to learn to manage expectations a little bit because a lot of times people look at a prototype and they think, boy, howdy, that's ready to go. And I've learned that's not the case. It's very encouraging. But treating this kind of, you know, from a, you know, kind of scientist at heart point of view, you know, the science is probably there. And this is all probably going to pan out. But there's a lot of other players that have to come in when you're really launching a product. And that's what adds these years to market launch. So, so I guess that's my answer to that question.
In that timeline of the 2 years minimum, you're what, 6 months into it?
You could say that it's very technology specific. It's very specific on what industrial partners we end up getting and working with, because we can leverage a lot of large resources to be able to bring this technology to market faster. But to give you an example, I'm on some other projects. I am working with a Fortune 500 company, and I have access to virtually unlimited resources to get this technology to market. And it still has followed that same rule of 4 years on average from this kind of initial stage. And that's just how it works. And, you know, I didn't understand this 4 or 5 years ago, but I think I understand it now. And I've talked to a lot of people who have developed a lot of products, and they tell me that's a decent rule of thumb. And I just try not to promise things, particularly when everything is boiling back to these kind of rural lighting electrifications. It's just not cool, I think, to promise people they're going to have some sort of rural electrification system that's stable and, you know, it's going to be ready for everybody to buy in Haiti when that's some years off. You know, I work on a solar water disinfection bag project as well. And part of the thing we're contending with is that once people see it and once it works, then seems like it's right around the corner. But getting a really stable distribution line and whatnot and setting up the manufacturing to be stable and whatnot for any product just takes more time. So we're having to manage expectations on that project as well. It's just I try not to make promises that are just impossible from a product development standpoint. So
along these lines, if somebody is interested in getting involved in your company from an investment point of view, is there are you open to that, or is it private, or how does that work?
We are a privately owned company, but we are, you know, always, I think startups always kind of talk to in court a little bit and, you know, do some shows and whatnot for investors, and we've certainly done that. But by and large now, we are not really looking for a flood of investors to come in. So we're kind of keeping it close to the vest. And not really openly searching for investors. The only investors we're talking to now are people who we've met and known for a while and through certain connections. But that could, you know, the reason for that is just because the time resources are so limited for us right now as a small company that we really are trying to vet out these different scales. Chat in talking with a huge array of investors and whatnot, it's kind of a full-time job. So for now, we're putting that off for some months, but I'm sure when we're actively looking, folks can see something on our website. So, but we're not a publicly traded, we're not public or anything like that. It's still privately held.
Along the lines of this open source to the developing world where patents aren't really plausible and you want to make it available,
right.
Do you have on your website a set of plans for using PVC pipe, for example? I see in my picture.
Good point. So I am working on exactly that system on this larger scale of between 1 to 10 watts, which would be really quite nice for quite a huge array of applications for rural electrification and a whole lot of other things too, like, you know, mesh Wi-Fi and whatnot. I'm tooling around with that sort of system that can be made largely from scratch. And my hope is, and, you know, I'm not the only one that governs whether or not this happens, but my hope is that I can post up some tech brief on building that sort of scale system from PVC pipe and whatnot in mid-January. But so people can feel free to bash me and send me nasty emails in mid-January if that doesn't happen. But I should probably promise a little bit later, but I'm trying to hold myself to that. But, you know, again, I'm kind of launching a few different products at the same time, so I kind of get caught in waves sometimes by these other projects. But that's what the hope is. By mid-January, this kind of build from PVC with specifics about where you need to put the magnet, where you can buy the material, what, you know, the dimensions of the material are, what the power output you should expect is at different wind speeds, etc. I'm hoping to post something like that mid-January. On the
what about a hybrid approach where you were saying earlier that getting some of the electrical components off the shelf might be expensive, whereas if you just provided as a kit the electrical component, that they could buy the power conditioning unit from you and then get everything else off the shelf, wouldn't that bring the price down? And is that something that you would envision as a short-term, as a transitional product?
We are looking at, we're chatting actually with some interesting folks who put out some nice educational kind of wind systems. They seem good at building what I guess would be called development kits. So we're talking to a few folks about this and, you know, eventually down the line, hopefully mid-2008, either through us or through a proxy, this sort of thing will be able to be launched where you do have the power conditioning unit, you have some material, you have, you know, some of the core stuff that's maybe harder to find, and then, you know, maybe you can, you know, build out your own sort of mounting structure at a PVC or whatnot. That's still a little bit in flux about how that's going to be, but from the get-go, what I want to do to get more people really vetting this technology out and doing their own sort of due diligence and peer review is I want to get some more information about how to reproduce it and what they should expect on the website in terms of just kind of a tech brief. And then after that, we'll probably put out some sort of kit. But, you know, just so people don't, you know, get too fearful of things like the power conditioning unit, once they see, I'll probably put up how to make that, probably. You know, that's a little bit in flux. But when I do publish that, which I will eventually, they'll see how simple it is. And you can really get all the components out of an old radio or at Radio Shack or whatnot and just glue it together yourself. It's really pretty easy. So nothing is really a burden with the technology once some of the more specifics are out there on paper.
All righty. Well, we have come just about to the end of this show. Is there anything burning that you've, in the last few seconds, you want to mention that we've not touched on yet?
No, I guess not. I'm just really excited that I think some other folks are excited about this technology. You know, you never know how people are going to accept it. There's definitely people who crap all over me, but besides that, I'm really excited that some other folks are starting to do some work on this technology, and I'm super excited to see how it develops over the next few years. And the next few months, this has just been going rocket speed the last year or so. And thanks a lot for asking me on. It's been great.
Well, you're certainly welcome. And we haven't mentioned that you hearken from MIT.
Oh, yeah, some time ago. Not too long ago, 5 years ago or so, I guess, 4.5, uh-huh. Something like that. But, yeah, that doesn't affect it. You know, no one should feel oppressed by that, because all this sort of everything that went into the wind belt is sort of middle school physics. And I think everyone can understand it. And if anyone has any questions, they can email me. My email's on the site.
Yeah. Well, very good. Again, your website is humdingerwind.com, spelled as it sounds. And we appreciate you coming on the show, and we wish you success in rolling this out.
Great. Thanks, Sterling.
You're welcome.
Been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net, and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.